Well, today my talk is going to be about the fourth of the four immeasurables, equanimity. Not long ago, I gave a talk on appreciative joy, and I've given various numerous talks in the past about compassion and loving kindness. So today I decided to share some of this teaching about equanimity, the fourth of the four immeasurables. So when I first came to Zen Center and I was about 24 years old, I did not have a lot of equanimity. I cultivated a calm demeanor, but inside I had, you know, a fair amount of stuff going on, inner turmoil, you know, and I really got in touch with that when I started to practice and especially to do Sishin. So any equanimity I found over the years of my practice is due to effort, the help of my teachers, and the teachings themselves, and the vow and the intention to cultivate these qualities. So although these four Brahma Viharas or immeasurables predated Buddhism, and Buddha didn't claim them as his own teaching, he taught them to his son, Rahula. He had this to say to Rahula about equanimity. Practice non-attachment to overcome prejudice. Non-attachment is the way of looking at all things openly and equally. This is because that is. Myself and others are not separate. Do not reject one thing only to chase after another. So I have the opportunity to meet regularly with various people to support them in their practice. And someone a little while back expressed confusion about the term non-attachment, because she's a mom who's got a little girl, and that little girl's need for attachment to her parents is very indisputable, actually. You know, we need our attachments to other human beings, and especially children growing up need to firm to create not only their ego consciousness, but also a firm attachment to their caregivers. So we talked about how non-attachment in Buddhism actually means letting go of our views, our fixed views about ourselves as a separate being, about other people, about reality itself, and to rather than seeing ourselves as a solid and changing entity, we see ourselves as a process, always moving and changing. And so we also learn to see our own clinging and aversion. So a key to practicing this is conveyed in this teaching from the third ancestor Zen, Singsan, in his verses of the heart-mind. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. His audience here with this is other monastics. The word love used here is akin less to liberation and more to the clinging aspect of love. In the sutra, which is much longer than this little excerpt, he gets to the heart of the matter. Practicing avoiding picking and choosing, going beyond I like this, I like that, I don't like this, I don't like that, and all the other pairs of dualities that we get caught by, both in formal practice and in our daily lives. It's a shin, you know, our formal retreats and our informal, less formal retreats are a great way to get in touch with how our minds work when we're in that picking and choosing mode. Someone else sets the schedule at retreat, prepares the food, rings the bells, and we just have to sit and walk, listen to a talk, and chew our rice. But we may notice unrest in the mind in the midst of the silence and peace of Sishin. This rice is undercooked. This salad is great. The breaks are too short. The sittings are too long. I don't like bowing. I love bowing, etc., etc. Because of the fact that our actual actions are pared down and simplified, we can easily see how our minds work, always picking and choosing in that setting where we don't have to make any decisions at all. We just have to be present with awareness. So we begin to study the self, to observe how our minds work, which is the start of insight. Insight is one key to equanimity. We need insight to see how we make a self and identify with it. We need insight to see how our minds want to attach to one side or another, and to begin to let go little by little of those habits of our mind, of preference, aversion, and clinging. So practicing the Brahma Viharas is relational and interactive. I came across this useful set of verses. Metta, or loving kindness, embraces all beings with friendliness. Compassion embraces all beings who suffer. Joy embraces happy and prosperous beings. Equanimity embraces the good and bad, the loved and unloved, the pleasant and unpleasant, without being tossed away, with calm and serenity. That sounds good, doesn't it? I want some of that. I want more of that. So according to Christina Feldman, who's my favorite teacher on the Brahma Viharas, equanimity gives selflessness to loving kindness, gives patience and fearlessness to compassion, and it guards joy from sentimentality. It's not a future state or attainment, but a way of engaging with all that's happening in the present moment. Sowing these seeds of equanimity rooted in a deep understanding of life and of our minds, we participate in shaping our present moment, mind and heart, which is the mother of our next moment. Let's imagine now standing at the center of a mandala, surrounded by the people we care about, those we struggle with, and all those we don't know. We can visualize ourselves surrounded by the 10,000 joys and sorrows that touch all of us. We can look back at the past as a river of experience, both joyful and difficult, that flows to the present. We look to the future and know that the only certainty is our death, though we don't know when or how it will happen. We do know we'll be asked to engage with our life. We have no power to predict what will come to us in the future in terms of joy and sorrow, or even in the next moment. We return to the knowledge that all that we are now is the outcome of all that we have been and experienced, and the knowledge that all we will be in the future will be the outcome of what and how we are now. That's karma. That's cause and effect. Widening the field of our attention, we sense all of the others standing in the center of their own mandalas, at times intersecting with our own and at times unknown to us. All of our mandalas intersect in the human story of vulnerability, aging, sickness, and death. We also share the experience of the mind possessing the potentials for deep compassion and understanding. We share the longing to be free from pain and sorrow, even as we know we'll continue to be touched by them. Our human mandalas intersect in our longing to be happy and safe, even when we know that won't always be possible. Our worlds intersect in our wish to protect those we love from suffering and loss, even though we know that's beyond our power. Equanimity has the capacity to embrace these paradoxes. The Buddha spoke about untangling the tangle within and without. He said that for those with mindfulness and clarity, whose greed, anger, and ignorance have faded, the tangle is untangled. We look at the world out there with all of its conflicts and suffering. The tangle of conflict and confusion seems to be endless. We see the climate crisis caused by human consumption and greed. We're feeling its effects right now, right? Extreme heat, wildfires, and floods are happening all over the world. I often think about the world my grandchildren and their children will be living in. What will it be like? What will their challenges be like? What will they face? We see all the lives affected by clashing ideologies and beliefs. We know we can't fix it all. We understand the pressing need to bring as much kindness and compassion to the tangles we find ourselves in as possible. We learn that our insistence that life, other people, and ourselves be different only intensifies the tangle. Through the gift of equanimity, we can begin to discover the inner stillness and poise that are available in the middle of chaos in the world. We can even sense it when there's turmoil in our own minds. If we contemplate it, it's underneath all of the turmoil and it's available. Sometimes we invest heroic effort in building defenses against change. Eventually we realize there's very little in the world that we can control no matter how we try. But we also come to know that we aren't helpless, and that we hold all the seeds of resilience and balance and the capacity for liberating insight. The ability to stand up in our lives with poise and balance rests on bringing these seeds we are planting to fruition. I listened to a talk recently by insight teacher Noah Levine, where he said the understanding that we can't prevent or remove the suffering of someone else, no matter how much we might want to, is like Buddhist Al-Anon. Al-Anon is a 12-step program dedicated to the freedom from codependency and its control dramas, with focus on spiritual growth of the individual self and without trying to fix or change someone else. Knowing the difference between what we can and can't change is part of what equanimity reveals. If our child falls down and skins her knee, we'll respond with care, right, and kindness. Maybe we'll clean the wound and we'll put a Band-Aid on it and give a hug. But we can't cover the ground with soft fabric to cushion every fall. And the examples related to our children only increase in complexity from there. So I think the best use of our energies will be in taking good care of ourselves and developing the seeds of wisdom and equanimity to balance our compassion. So let's pause for a minute here and do a practice, a little practice, a little guided meditation related to this. And this is from Christina Feldman's book, Boundless Heart, that I'm taking this practice. So find just a comfortable seat. Find your seat that you're, I think, already in, and begin to settle into an intentional and wakeful posture, sensitive to the life of your mind and body. You can just close your eyes or keep them partly open. Expand your awareness to remember the many people who are part of your life just now. Those you love, those you struggle with, and the many you do not know. Sense your capacity to care deeply, yet simultaneously know that there will always be limits to the effect you can have upon the heart of another. Sense what it is to rest your attention in a few simple phrases. Life is but a play of joy and sorrow. May I remain unshaken by life's rise and fall. I care for you deeply, but you are the parent of your acts and their fruit, and sadly, I cannot protect you from pain. Life is but a play of joy and sorrow. May I remain unshaken by life's rise and fall. I care for you deeply, but you are the parent of your acts and their fruit, and sadly, I cannot protect you from distress. So coming back, these few simple phrases capture the heart of equanimity, and it's a seed of intention planted again and again. Where am I? I don't know. So the Buddha once said, it would make no sense to me, being subject to change, uncertainty, and death, to try to find refuge in that which is also subject to change, uncertainty, and death. So to understand this very deeply is to cease our frantic attempts to attempt to control the uncontrollable and learn to be still in the midst of this life with an open heart that's willing to embrace all of our moments with poise and spaciousness. Just as time and life don't stand still, exempt from change, equanimity is equally fluid. It's a responsive way of meeting our shifting life and changing body and mind and all of the events we're asked to embrace. It's not developed in the sublime and peaceful moments in our life, but in the moments we feel most agitated, the most lost and unbalanced. It's a practice of meeting and understanding the uncertainty and unpredictability we so fear, and a commitment to the freedom of our own minds and hearts in right in the midst of it. My root teacher, Katagiri Roshi, was really interested in this topic about equanimity amidst chaos. He often talks about not being tossed away and standing up in the middle of your life no matter what's happening. There's a story that I wanted to share with you from. It's a story he told us in talks, and it's also in the book Andrea edited called Each Moment is the Universe. So I'm going to read this story to you. When I was in a Heiji monastery, I had a very big shock. A big earthquake happened suddenly, just as the monks were about to leave the zendo. The moment they began to step out, the earthquake started. Everybody was very surprised. The monks immediately ran away to some huge cedar trees in a vacant lot, where the big tree roots could protect them from the breaking ground. Even famous Roshis ran to the trees. Nobody seemed to notice that a candle was burning on the altar, but one Roshi went back into the zendo and blew it out. This Roshi was a monk whom others always looked down on because of his particular characteristics. But when the great Zen masters ran away, only he took care of the candle. He laughed and said, "Isn't it a terrible earthquake?" And there's more stories he tells in this section about the reactions of different people to the shock. It's interesting that he also focuses on the point that we don't know how we'll react when something terrifying or shocking or difficult happens to us. We may have an intellectual understanding of equanimity, but experience is what tests and refines our understanding and our ability to respond. I remember him talking about death and saying, "You don't know how you're going to be." There's all these stories about Zen masters who die perfectly in their seat doing zazen. And he said, at the time, I don't know how I'll react. I might scream and scream. Of course he didn't when his time came. So in Buddhism, there's the teaching of the eight worldly winds, moments of success and failure, praise and blame, pleasure and pain, gain and loss come to all of our lives. In the light of approval and praise, we glow. In the light of blame and disapproval, we can shrink into ourselves and feel shame. Understandably, we long for acceptance and appreciation, but we too often place ourselves at the whims of another's words of affirmation for us. Understandably, blame, criticism, and judgment are hard to bear. The near enemy of this pain is to seek for an elusive perfection or to deaden ourselves or deafen ourselves to feedback from others. We're prone to personalize both praise and blame, describing ourselves by them and subjecting ourselves to either elation or despair. Equanimity disappears in the contraction of our identification with these feelings. We love health, lovely emotions, and pleasant thoughts. We don't open so easily to the moments of pain. We develop the habit of leaning into and pursuing the pleasant and doing all we can to arrange the conditions of our lives in ways that protect us from pain. We don't often appreciate that our very pursuit of pleasure and ease makes us increasingly intolerant of pain and develops into a life of anxiety and agitation. But equanimity has a quality of resilience that is not an armoring against the winds of the world, but is born of inner poise and strength. We're affected deeply by the unexpected changes and events of the lovely and the unlovely. We can bend with the force of those winds, but learn to return to uprightness. In cultivating the capacity for balance, we learn how to face the many small moments of discomfort that are part of our lives without flinching or turning away, discovering that it's possible to surround discomfort with stillness and calm. Zazen is our primary way of cultivating this ability, and retreats are how we can deepen that ability to deal with discomfort without moving away from it. We can also discover the capacity to meet the many small, lovely moments of our day with an appreciativeness that isn't distorted by a desire to possess those moments. Cultivating gratitude, and I've said this over and over again, for the small blessings in life is a way to counter both the negativity bias in our brains as well as develop a balanced way of interacting with those blessings. Appreciating our lives can extend to appreciating even the moments of growth that are difficult. We can appreciate how our responses to difficulty have changed over time with our practice and bring more balance to acceptance of both the difficult and the pleasant. Excuse me. So in the middle of pleasure and pain, success and failure, gain and loss, praise and blame, we can remind ourselves of the possibility of meeting the winds of the world with a calm, still sense of balance. And as in the cultivation of the other Brahma Viharas, this remembering is supported by a few simple phrases that help us return to equanimity in the moments we feel in danger of being overwhelmed. So I'd like to share another guided meditation with you on this particular point. So again, turn within, close your eyes or cast them down, relax and listen to the guided meditation. In the midst of a life with its 10,000 joys and sorrows, We can simply attend to how we are present just now. Allow the body to come to stillness and the mind to settle, bearing witness to the life of this moment, however it is. In the midst of the lovely, in the midst of the difficult, we make our home in our capacity to embrace, include, and care for the well-being of our hearts. May I embrace change with stillness and calm. May I deeply accept this moment as it is. May my home be a home of balance and spaciousness. May I embrace change with stillness and calm. May I deeply accept this moment as it is. May my home be a home of balance and spaciousness. Each time we return to an intentional way of being, with the easy and the difficult, we're untangling those patterns of aversion and craving that lead us to abandon our moments. Through flights of aversion, we can build fences that make our world smaller, telling ourselves we can't handle this life as it is. Equanimity teaches us to live as if we're a mountain, touched by the winds of the world, but unshaken. A Zen master was once asked, "What is the secret of your happiness?" He answered, "Complete, unrestricted cooperation with the unavoidable." I like that. Complete, unobstructed cooperation with the unavoidable. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. The unavoidable in our life is just as it is. You know, there's a phrase people use, right? It is what it is. Does that resonate with you, or are you irritated by that phrase? It is just as it is, though, is a good little mantra that we can use, particularly when we're going through some long-term difficult experience, like caregiving for our parents or other experiences. We can use these phrases and mantras, and we can make them up ourselves. And making them up is a good idea because we, you know, resonate more with our own words. So a typical guided meditation on any of these Brahma Viharas would be something like 15 minutes long, and you would be repeating your phrases over and over and timing them with your breath. So intention is the secret ingredient in cultivating all of these Brahma Viharas. The phrases that are used are there to plant the seeds of metta, loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And I'll end today, even though this talk has only scratched the surface of the topic, with a practice that can be done in just a brief pause in your day. Maybe putting your hand on your heart, focusing on the heart center while letting the breath go. May I be happy with myself as I am. May I be peaceful with things as they are. May I live with ease, balance, and joy. May I be free. So thank you very much for listening. It's been a pleasure to be able to speak with you today.